from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The campaign for the presidency hinges in no small part on U.S. job growth, and job growth in July looked lousy. Jobs grew by only a fraction of what was expected. Payrolls were up by 32,000 instead of the anticipated 200,000 plus. At this rate, George Bush could be the first president since the Great Depression to leave the country with fewer American jobs than when he entered the White House. Yet we are told that the economy is recovering. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan assures us that recent weak economic reports represent just a soft spot. Tonight, we look at the nation's economic future, the presidential campaign, and ask, where are the jobs? We begin in New York with John Hilzenrath, business reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I asked him about the recent jobs report and why it's created such concern.
The economic recovery officially started in November of 2001. We went a long time without producing any jobs. And it looked earlier this year like the tide had started to turn on that. We were getting several months in a row of job gains of in excess of a couple of 100,000. Now, for the last 2 months, we've had job growth that's been below expectations, and people are starting to wonder if we're running out of steam in the recovery already. There are a couple of reasons to be concerned. The most obvious one is that oil prices have gone up to nearly $45 a barrel, and there's a growing worry that this is creating a real drain on household incomes and their ability to spend on things, you know, outside of the gasoline station. There's also, I think, mounting uncertainties on a number of issues, including the presidential elections, the outlook for tax policy, the outlook for possible terrorist actions in the U.S. and overseas and in Iraq. And, I mean, it seems like these uncertainties are starting to build and potentially having an effect on business executives. I mean, there's a possibility that the corporate world is deciding that it's going to sit tight for a couple of months and see where these elections go and whether we're heading for another rash of terrorist activity.
So there's concern about the no-show, non-appearance of jobs. But the larger concern is whether that is an indicator that the recovery itself is not going as well as it should, just hit a soft spot, as Alan Greenspan
said.
Well,
that's what Greenspan calls it, is a soft spot. And I don't talk to many people who would make the argument today that the recovery itself is in jeopardy. But there's an important distinction to be made here. You know, you can have a recovery, but if the growth rate slows down in a $10 trillion economy, we're talking about a lot of output and income that isn't created. You know, the difference from 4% growth to 3% growth is about $100 billion of economic activity, and there are a lot of jobs that are attached to that. So a slowdown itself would be something that we should be concerned about. Greenspan doesn't think it's going to last very long, but after this latest jobs report, I think everyone is reevaluating that, including the Fed. The Fed is actually meeting tomorrow to determine the course of interest rates. Everyone's expecting a small interest rate increase tomorrow, as you know, the Fed has been signaling that for several months. But the view in the market is that the Fed's going to have to reconsider just how aggressively it's going to be pushing rates up through the rest of the year.
John, economists were saying in advance of Friday's job numbers that they were expecting to see July producing 215,000 jobs or more.
Yeah.
Of course, in the end, it was 32,000. How do they decide what they expect? What's the thinking on what dragged it so far down?
That's a good question. There are a couple of points that need to be made on that. One is that these predictions are really hard to make. The difference between 250,000 jobs and 30,000 jobs in percentage terms is actually very small. 240,000 jobs in a workforce with 130 million people is 0.2%. 32,000 jobs is essentially flat. So they missed by 0.2% if you look at it in percentage terms.
And yet, in terms of the growth in the labor pool, they need that bigger growth, or there's hundreds of thousands of people presumably without jobs.
Exactly. I mean, the point there is just that these predictions are hard to make, but the market sets its expectations based on those predictions. The other thing that people should keep in mind is that when the Labor Department came out with those numbers on Friday, there are actually two reports that go into making that Friday report. One is a survey of business establishments, and that's considered to be a pretty good indicator of how many jobs are being created. The other is a survey of households, about 60,000 households, and that number actually wasn't so weak. there's been a debate running in economics for several months now about which of these two surveys is giving a truer picture of the economy. If you believe the household survey...
And this is the survey that produces the unemployment figure, which actually went down.
Exactly. It went down, and the number of jobs in that survey, the number of jobs created, was actually very large. It was in excess of 600,000 new jobs. Now, that survey tends to be more volatile, which is why people tend to focus on the other survey, which showed 32,000 jobs. But it's a reason for some caution in overreacting to these latest numbers. It does look like we have a slowdown, but I don't think anyone, you know, should think that the recovery is going down the tubes.
And yet the markets on Friday were expressing an awful lot of concern.
Right, because the markets are driven on expectations. And in June, we had a lot of soft economic data. And everyone, including Chairman Greenspan, had kind of set the market up to expect that we were going to see a turnaround in July. Some of the consumer spending numbers were a little bit stronger in July. So the market was not positioned for a disappointment, and that's what it got.
Let's look at who comes out ahead in the November 2nd race. How much does that affect economists' thinking, investor thinking, about where this jobs number goes down the road a year from now?
The economists that we've been talking to are revising down their growth estimates for the second half of the year. I think they are factoring in higher oil prices and increased uncertainty, and they're seeing slightly less growth than had been expected through the end of the year. And Kerry is going to do better the more economic uncertainty that we have. I mean, that's just the way this election is set up. Bush is going to get credit for a recovery, and Kerry is going to get credit for any stumbles that the economy takes. So it's kind of perverse, but he's in a position where he's got to kind of root for the numbers not to look very strong.
And yet everyone has to make the case that they'll bring stronger numbers. John Hilsenrath, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
John Hilsenrath is a business reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from New York. I'm joined now by representatives from each of the campaign camps. Kevin Madden is in Arlington, Virginia. He is a spokesman for the Bush-Cheney campaign. Kevin Madden, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And David Barrett, a Democratic spokesman and economic analyst, joins us from Hilton Head, South Carolina. David Barrett, thank you for joining us.
Great, Tom. Thank you.
So here we have these numbers. Really not good at all for job creation in July. Lots of woe from the market and economists over the weekend. We want to get a sense from each of you of how your respective campaigns are looking at this and what they plan to do about it. Kevin Madden, let me turn first to you and the Bush-Cheney campaign. Here we've got a good surge earlier in the year, a lot of promise. People got excited, over a million jobs created in the first 6 months. But now, lousy numbers in July. The Bush administration is still down 1.2 million jobs from when Bush took office. And, of course, the workforce has grown by a million since that time. In addition, what's your assessment of this poor showing in July? And what's the Bush-Cheney prescription for addressing it?
You know, the president looks forward to making the case that the pro-growth economic policies that he's put in place are helping the economy move in the right direction. And we are seeing growth. The economy created 32,000 new payrolls in July. That actually marks it as the 11th straight month of gains. But we have to make sure that we do keep moving the economy in the right direction, and we have seen positive economic indicators. The key, once again, now that we have to look at is the difference between the two employment surveys. We saw 629,000 Americans enter the workforce in July, and causing a net drop in unemployment of 52,000. So the gap between these two surveys has narrowed a bit in recent months, and it shows that the economy is back and strong. And I think it's very important to point out that the unemployment rate dropped to 5.5 during this time.
But you know, of course, Kevin Madden, that economists were looking for well in excess of 200,000 new jobs. They got 32,000 instead. That's close to zero in economic terms. What's your assessment of why it wasn't stronger?
Well, I think we have to look at the payroll survey. I mean, or we have to look at the household survey as well in order to gauge the economic growth in this country. I mean, the fact that 629,000 Americans entered the workforce is a good sign. I think it means that more Americans are working than ever and that they're taking advantage more than ever of the flexibility that's being provided in today's economy and today's job force market.
But you're essentially just looking past this number. You're not accepting it as a problem. Yet a lot of economists and the market clearly are.
Well, I think we have to look at all the other numbers. I think if you just take just one, you can extrapolate any sort of information that you want. I think if we look at the last 11 months, the simple fact that the economy has expanded and that jobs have been created And the fact that if you look at the last 10 months, we're looking at 1.5 million new jobs that have been created in this country.
David Barrett, let me turn to you, if I may. How do you interpret the July numbers, 32,000 new jobs, and what's the Kerry prescription for addressing that problem?
Well, let's start with an understanding of the problem, Tom. America and the American consumer is overburdened and overextended financially. America has a domestic deficit of over $500 billion a year and an international trade deficit of over $500 billion a year. That's $1 trillion a year, and there is no end in sight. There is no plan on the books, on the drawing, whatever.
Kevin Madden says they're pro-growth. They're going to keep pushing ahead on this. President Bush says we've turned a corner. We're not going back. Do you buy it?
No, I don't buy it. And I'll tell you what is happening. The debt load, both for the Americans and the country, is increasing every year. And that is the reason. It's that debt load which is wearing on the stock market.
So you don't like the debt and the deficits. What would a Kerry Edwards administration do about creating more jobs? What's the plan?
There is no future for America without the creation of jobs. America's future depends entirely on what John Kerry made as his number one statement when he announced that he was running for president, that we have to create 10 million jobs in the next 4 years.
Easy to say, hard to do. How would he do it?
Easy to say, hard to do. First of all, let's take a look at where we are today. We have a tax code that encourages companies to move their business overseas and to move jobs overseas. It's called a tax deferral. And the way it works is if you open a business in China and send those goods to the United States, the profit you make is not taxed until you return those funds to the United States. That costs an enormous amount of money, and more importantly, is encourages your major corporations to open businesses in other parts of the world.
So you think it's mainly about jobs going overseas rather than better educating American workers or changing the economics at home?
I don't think there's a simple solution. I don't think there's a wand out there. And unfortunately, this administration always approaches the problem that way, as if tomorrow it's going to be better. Tomorrow it's not going to be better until you begin to take very strong action.
Kevin Madden, let me turn to you. Second Bush administration, what would be done that wasn't done in the first administration? Can't really do too many more tax cuts, I guess. So what's left in the holster?
Well, I think first, I mean, let me address the fact that the John Kerry campaign, I mean, what you just heard right there was a non-answered answer. I mean, that was all platitudes and cliches. And John Kerry's tax code would actually encourage multinational companies to designate their headquarters overseas. What the president would do, and the president would continue to do, is put in place these pro-growth economic policies that we've seen over the last 3.5 years.
But such also, as more tax cuts? Is that what you mean by that?
Actually, no, make the tax cuts permanent. That's an important part of this president's economic plan. We also have to continue to make health care costs more affordable so that companies can reduce costs in doing business in this country. Tort reform, medical liability reform, those are two big issues that are causing companies higher costs of business in this country, and they're also weighing heavily on consumers, which is actually dampening some commercial activity. If we happen to put in place tort reform and medical liability reform, we can unleash more commercial activity, create more jobs in this country.
First of all, John Kerry is for cutting the deficit in half. Let's just run through John Kerry's program.
You can't just say that you want to cut the deficit in half without a plan for it.
We got 1 minute left, David Barrett. Take us on through the program, if you would.
Okay. Cut the deficit in half over the course of the next 4 years. Reduce the corporate tax rate by 5%. Most importantly, enforce our trade agreements so that America is treated fairly. This administration has never enforced a trade agreement yet with any country at any time. And the countries have taken advantage of the American workers. It's scandalous. And they refuse to do anything about it.
John Kerry has a 19-year history of raising taxes and burdening businesses with regulation. He has 19 years of failed economic policies. To say with just a mere platitude that he would cut the deficit is untrue, and it does not highlight the fact that his record speaks to the exact opposite.
And yet it's grown enormously during the Bush administration as well. A lot to ponder here, but with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Kevin Madden with the Bush-Cheney campaign, thank you for joining us. And David Barrett, Democratic spokesman and economic analyst, thank you for joining us as well. Thanks to you both.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking tonight about lousy job numbers and uncertain economy in the U.S. presidential election. We're told we've had a recovery. Where are the jobs? Which candidate for the White House has a jobs fix for America? George Bush, John Kerry, none of the above. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at last Friday's sagging new job numbers. Job growth in July, 32,000. Very, very low. Far below what the nation needs to keep up with its labor pool, growing labor pool and demands of the workforce. We're going to look into all that tonight. You can join the conversation. How would you create more jobs in the USA? Is your November vote riding on economic performance, on job numbers? And George Bush says the economy has turned a corner. What do you see around the bend? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined tonight with me in the studio, Thomas Kochan, economist at the Institute for Work and Employment Research at MIT's Sloan School of Management, author of Employment Relations in a Changing World Economy. Thomas Kochan, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here, Tom.
And joining me tonight from New York, Alan Sinai, chief global economist and president of Decision Economics, Inc., an economic advisory firm serving financial institutions, corporations, governments, individual investors. Alan Sinai, thank you for joining us tonight.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. And thank you. Great to have you with us. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Welcome to you and welcome to our guests.
So here we are. Job numbers down on Friday. Alan Sinai, markets didn't like it. Nobody liked it. The Democrats raising Cain about it. George Bush saying we're on track. Let's stay the course. How are you interpreting the significance of this low, low number on Friday?
Well, the economy is not creating nearly the number of jobs. This is the kind of jobs, not of people working. We want to remember that. As it normally does in an expansion of the size and scope that we have. Why aren't we on this particular survey, the business survey, why isn't business adding as many jobs as before? I think the answer is business doesn't want to hire people. It's very costly, and they do everything they can to avoid it, and it shows up in productivity growth. I do want to note, and we should note, that another survey, the household survey, which counts people working, not number of jobs, which includes those working in agriculture, which is very small, and those who are single proprietors, sole proprietors, working on their own. That survey, and that's the one that underlies the unemployment rate, which went down.
Right, right.
That survey showed an increase of 629,000 people. It says 629,000 people on a seasonally adjusted basis found work. That was actually very, very strong. So we have actually a huge discrepancy between the two surveys over the span since January 2001, and over the last 8 or 9 months. A tremendous discrepancy, larger than any time in history.
Historically, as you say, as you indicate, these have tracked pretty well. This time, they call something like 60,000 households and ask them who's working. They call or survey 160-some thousand companies, as I understand. Alan Sinai, what's your gut tell you, or your fabulous intellect? Do we split the difference here in terms of what's going on with job creation?
I think we can explain some of the discrepancy and see what kind of implications we all draw from it. The business or jobs count is what economists tend to prefer. First, sample surveys larger. Two, it tells us what's going on in the business. Three, historically, it's tracked a little better to something we all have to forecast. Many of us have to forecast GDP.
And this is the number that's showing more or less a bust in July.
That's correct. The 32,000 number. Now, if I am working three or four jobs, as so many Americans did in the late 90s, I am counted as four if the businesses with which I am working get surveyed in the business or establishment survey, the one that gave us the lousy number. I am counted as one in a household survey. I'm just working.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, as I say, showed 629,000 people, more people gainfully employed. Which one, from a political point of view, describes how consumers feel is an interesting question for debate. I could argue, and I think I believe, that if I have a job, even if I have a job and I got a job, working myself, even if it isn't as good a job as I had before. But I am doing something, maybe contract work for a company, and I'm a sole proprietor as a result, earning money where I wasn't earning money before, say last year or the year before, that from my point of view, things are getting better. Indeed, historically, the unemployment rate has told us a lot about how consumers feel. So it's a mixed bag, and I think one survey says business doesn't want to hire, and I run a business. I'm the same way. I'm very cautious in hiring people. It's very expensive. It's not just the wages you pay. Another one says we got a lot of people working on their own in good and bad and all kinds of jobs, which are not surveyed in the business survey, and many more of them are finding work, earning money.
So a couple of different
people are spending.
A couple of different tunes there. But then, Tom Kochan, when we look at consumer spending, has been the mainstay of the economy in this recovery, fell 0.7% in June. At the same time, we've got economic growth overall down from 4.5% in the first quarter to 3% in the second quarter. That's a big drop as well. So a soft patch, as Alan Greenspan says, or something more serious in these numbers?
Well, Tom, I think there's a lot of uncertainty out there. Our other commentators already talked about the uncertainty in the business world, and that's what keeps the establishment job numbers from moving forward. People are afraid to hire. The biggest concern is the cost of health insurance, and until we address that issue, I'm afraid we're going to continue to see business reluctant to hire, and we're going to see worries about the deficit that bother business leaders as well.
Because every hire means paying that much more to get them covered with insurance, and it's too big.
The fixed costs of hiring are very high and growing. And so we've got to address that question no matter who's in the White House. There's also a great deal of uncertainty, I believe, in the minds of consumers and workers. People are not only concerned about their current job, they're concerned about losing that job, they're concerned about the increase in interest rates that are costing their mortgages more to go up. I think all of these things add together so that there's so much uncertainty in the economy and so much worry on the part of both workers and on the part of business leaders that we are going to see this soft patch continue for quite a while.
Jack Beatty, that uncertainty is exactly what both presidential campaigns are targeting. George Bush to bolster those spirits and saying we're on the right track. John Kerry saying we've got to change course or we're all in trouble. Big factor in this fall's election campaign.
It is. And I think what we have from the candidates is talking points, economics. President Bush last week and in his stump speech says that the key to creating jobs is to keep his tax cuts for the top 1%. Why? Because many of people in the top 1% are small business people. They derive their income from their businesses. Anything that gives them more income means they'll hire more people. Well, in fact, only 4% of the income of the top 1% comes from sole proprietorships. And a lot of that is just in investment partnerships. So it's a tiny fraction. That's not a serious proposal. It's an ideological and political line. And then with Kerry, I mean, he says he's going to create 10 million new jobs. When you start to look at the fine point, I mean, there's not nearly, and he has this job credit. That seems to be the big thing. Keep a company here. If you keep a job here, we'll give you a job credit. Well, that isn't going to be nearly enough to offset the immense wage advantage of foreign work for most companies. And studies, in fact, one study done for John Heinz, Theresa Heinz's late husband, in 1981 on a similar program in the Carter administration, found that all this did, this jobs credit did, was to reward companies that were going to keep jobs here or hire here in any case. So that it really didn't add any new net job.
That's not a big recommendation for that particular policy point. Alan Sinai, we've heard a lot about the slow return of jobs or the no-show of jobs in this entire recovery. We hear a lot about, well, it's because we have greater productivity, more technology being put to work instead of new hires, and jobs going overseas. But there's also now emerging, as people wait and wait and wait for the big jobs growth, and this administration lagging way behind many other administrations in what has been created, maybe even a net loss of jobs, the idea that there may somehow be a changed relationship between economic growth and job creation, that there may be some fundamental change we're in the midst of, so that we might have recovery without jobs, not very good for a democracy or for any economy.
Well, I think that's exactly what the story is. We have structural changes in the labor market. which have to do with businesses' reluctance to hire people and create jobs in the business environment for reasons of keeping costs down and maximizing profits. And the reasons, a couple of reasons have been touched on by my colleagues on this panel. Healthcare costs is one, but I think what's going on is we have a lot of outsourcing, and the outsourcing is just outsourcing functions here at home to other companies or sole proprietorships that take on the functions that previously were covered by jobs in a company. It's just that the healthcare costs, the pension fund costs, the administrative costs, all the insurance costs, business would rather pay somebody else outside to do the work than have it inside. We also are outsourcing overseas. That number's not that great, but there's a lot of it going on for certain kinds of telephone and other jobs. Technology has wiped out a tremendous number of jobs, agent, ticket taker, order taker kinds of jobs. But what's behind it all is the mentality of American business, who have been turning in incredibly good profits results, simply not wanting to have people in the business establishment and trying to get as much output and profits as they can without people through all kinds of devices. And I don't think it's going to go away, and certainly the technology revolution is not going to go away. So we will continue to see on the non-farm business tally fewer jobs per unit of GDP than we've ever seen before in an expansion of this kind. And it shows up by definition as increased productivity.
Tom Kochan, what a challenge for a president, then. If you've got growth, whatever level, and it doesn't come with jobs, this is clearly not an acceptable social situation, whatever it means economically over time. How can, should the U.S. government, the White House, whoever's sitting in it, address a situation like that? What do you do?
Well, I think this is a terribly difficult problem, and one has to really put job creation as a top economic priority. We can't have a world where we use tax cuts for a whole bunch of other reasons and then argue that in the long run they will create jobs. We have to have a much more direct approach. If we're going to use tax cuts, then they have to be cuts that get at people who are going to spend the money rather than save the money. And so it has to go to lower income people, middle income families. We have to really get
more. But a tax cut isn't a job.
No. We have to
get, you're saying to create consumer spending
to
there?
To create consumer spending. We also have to really start to worry about how we get more money into the hands of people by improving the jobs that they have. That is, by increasing their wages, by getting some of the burden of health insurance off of individual firms, by rebuilding some countervailing power in the labor market, by increasing the minimum wage and earn income tax credits, by rebuilding unions so that they can start to improve some of these jobs. This is a package of policies that are going to take a long time to recover from the situation we're in. And so we have to be in it for the long haul. We can't expect that month to month we're going to see a major turnaround. But I think a sustained policy that says job creation is important, the quality of jobs are important, education and training to improve the productivity of the American workforce and to stay on the cutting edge of technology. All of this fits together, and if we stay with it, we will have a sustained both economic growth policy and a job growth policy.
So, Alan Sinai, between the two candidates, Bush and Kerry, which do you see laying out a general economic program that's more likely to create that sustained effort, focus, and ultimately job growth?
Actually, I'd have to say neither one is really attacking the problem appropriately yet, because I don't think they quite have the diagnosis right. I think the three of us have given the diagnosis in different ways. It's going to stay, and so you really need to do something about one of the major costs of business, which is, and major drains on the budget, federal budget deficit in the out years, which has to do with rising healthcare costs and healthcare inflation that's far above average of inflation anywhere else. It's a tremendous cost to business, keeps them from hiring people, and it's a tremendous cost on our budget.
But both candidates say that they have plans to address the healthcare crisis.
They say we'd have to ask a lot of people whether they think there's much substance behind mm-hmm. other candidates' plans, and depending on where you are in the political spectrum, somebody might say, yeah, fine, but frankly, I'm not, nothing's knocking my turning my lights on anything I'm seeing on healthcare, nor on the deficit, frankly, from either candidate. Jobs tax credits on the margin can help, but not big time stuff. And I absolutely agree with my colleagues that tax cuts for the highest income families, only indirectly and with long lags, will create some jobs. You need to support spending, and if we're going to maintain tax cuts, they should be for the middle and lower income tax bracket families. They'll spend money, and we have a big job to do in education. There's also a big mismatch. Technology is wiping out a lot of kind of straightforward, fairly simple jobs. We can order books anywhere from anywhere we want. We can order lots of anything from anywhere we want. Technology is wiping out those jobs, but there are a lot of jobs that require certain skill levels that many companies who want to fill those jobs can't find the right kind of people. And that says we need to pay attention, much more attention to education. And both candidates claim they're education presidents, and we'll just see what else comes out of them. You notice I'm walking a fine line here between
yes, I do.
Sides.
Yes, I do. It's very clear.
On these, but I, you know, as a citizen and a voter, neither one is showing me the right stuff yet.
Tom Kochan, come in here. Alan Sinai is walking that tightrope. I heard in your earlier comments with the kind of got to buttress labor and unions that you may be leaning the Democratic way. But tell us, I mean, even if the details are short, there's a gist in these economic programs which feels different. So which way do you lean when you look at the details, when you look at the gist?
Well, I agree with Alan that there's a lot more to be said and a lot more to be done. But clearly the Kerry campaign has laid out a program that addresses the issues much more directly than the Bush administration has in the last 3.5 years. I do think there's more to be done, and I think the work has to go from not only the macro level, but we have to look at the industry level. We've done a good job of working with universities and local regional networks. I think the creation of jobs, the creation of new products and services and technologies is an area where there's a tremendous opportunity to bring business, education, and even the labor movement together to ask, what are the skills of the future? What are the jobs of the future? And if we can get some concerted efforts, some collaborative efforts by all of these parties really focusing on these issues, I think we will make progress, but it's going to take a sustained effort. It can't just be a superficial program.
Alan Sinai, we've just got 30 seconds before the break, and I know we have to lose you. What's your level of optimism as we sit here tonight that the country, that its leadership is adjusting to this fundamentally new structure?
Well, I think the political process is beginning to flesh out the kinds of generalized comments that tell me something's cooking that will show up in some substance after we get after the election and through Congress. I have to say that Senator Kerry is sounding like generally more of the gist of some of the things that have to happen, talking about energy, talking about health care, talking about education. That's the right general direction. I've just been around a long time, so when I listen to politicians of either party tell us things, I kind of say, give me the substance, give me the details, and I'll make a judgment. We have to be fair, though, to both candidates, and the Republican convention hasn't happened yet, and the real campaign hasn't started yet.
Well, we'll see. Alan Sinai, I know we've got to let you go right there. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure, thanks.
Alan Sinai, Chief Global Economist at Decision Economics. We're talking tonight about lousy job numbers and uncertain economy and the election. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about sagging new job numbers for the month of July, just out late last week. About those numbers, about an uncertain economy and the presidential election, you can join the conversation tonight. George Bush says the economy has turned a corner. What do you see around the bend? And John Kerry wants to keep American corporations at home. Is that the path to new jobs? Can you feel the soft spot crimping consumer spending, crimping your spending? What's going on with the U.S. economy? Where are the jobs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas Kochan's joining us tonight. He's an economist at MIT's Sloan School of Management. And our own Jack Beattie is with us as well. And right now from Decorah, Iowa, Scott's calling. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. At the top of your program, you mentioned that the current administration is at risk of being the first since Hoover to preside over a net job loss.
That is right. Until last Friday, until July, President Bush needed to create or needed to see 190,000 new jobs a month through December to avoid the Herbert Hoover distinction. Now, with the bad report on Friday, he needs to see 234,000 new jobs generated every month, August through to December, to avoid that. That's right, Scott.
Yeah. My concern is that there's the risk of attributing that solely to effects from September 11th. I think a more cogent fact is that since 1900, if you rank all of the administrations in job creation, there is no comparison. Even the worst Democratic administration still created more jobs than even the best, in fact, all of the Republican administrations. So my question is, why have the Democrats batted 1,000 on this for over a century, and what possible reason can Republicans give for us to ignore that century of dominance?
Scott, let us pick it up. Tom Kokin, now, I don't have the chart in front of me, but I saw one just over the weekend, and it did show some very big job creation that we can only, seems, dream about now, of millions and millions of jobs in the 60s, in the 90s, but also in the 80s. Reagan made quite a few jobs in there. I don't know if Scott's got it exactly right. What's your sense overall of job creation, Republican versus Democratic administrations?
Scott's got it generally right, but there were years, particularly during some of the Reagan years, where jobs were growing at a very rapid rate after we came out of the deep recession of 1981 to 1983. So it's not, but that's whether it's exactly or generally right. What it takes to create jobs over the long haul is confidence in the business sector, strong, concerted efforts to make sure that the tax policies, the macroeconomic policies are ones that get money into the hands of consumers who spend those dollars so that you have a much more equitable economy, a much more equitable distribution of wealth, so that people at the bottom can spend money, can improve their conditions, improve their standards of living, and we grow together. When we have created the most jobs are exactly the same times when the overall economy has grown together, when we have gone farther and farther apart as an economy and as a society. That's when we get into deep trouble. That's where we are today. The people at the bottom and the people even in the middle are working longer hours, but they're not able to get ahead economically, and they don't have the disposable income that allows them to contribute to the economic expansion and growth. So we have to get back to that kind of a situation and that kind of philosophy, not only of economic policy, but as Scott said, of social policy in this country, so that we all prosper together.
So close the gaps, it pumps up consumer spending, and more jobs get created. And does that work even when China sits there with its competitive threat and its huge pool of labor? India, the same. Does it still work now, 2004?
Clearly, we're in a much more global economy, but many of our jobs are service sector jobs that are not going to be exported to other countries. There are jobs where wages have declined relative to the overall wage distribution, income distribution. If we can address some of those issues, I think we can make some progress. Then we have to work on the very high end of the labor market, where the new jobs will be created, the new industries, the new technologies, so that those jobs that are at risk will be replaced by better jobs in the future.
Scott, thanks for your call. Lauren is calling from Greenleaf, Wisconsin. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, gentlemen, tonight?
Great, Lauren. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
Okay. I have 3 points to make. Number one is I think of what a lot of it, I've experienced it myself, is where there's a lot of companies now that are making wonderful profits. They're really reaping some wonderful benefits out of the pro-corporate policy that's out there now, and they're refusing to hire people. I mean, they're just basically saying, hey, we can't afford to, put extra people on. So you're seeing a lot of people, especially salaried folks, that are putting in 50, 60-hour weeks, still trying to do their jobs, so that they don't get fired, and, not being able to basically get ahead, working more hours.
Business is up, you're saying, but it's actually just the extra work's being done by people who already have the jobs.
Right, exactly. People aren't being replaced as they're being let go. The other point, and I'll make 2 points and then I'll listen. The other point I wanted to make is I think if we had gone to a green economy, there's a lot of potential out there for solar use and solar, not only solar, but wind power. There's a lot of technologies out there that could be explored and would also create jobs.
Got it. And your final point, Lauren?
My third point, and probably most importantly, I know myself, I think from keeping myself from going to being a self-employed small business starter, is not having any health care. And that's part of the reason that keeps me working for somebody else. And I really think if we had national health care, you would see a jump start in small business and you would see a jump start in the economy because people wouldn't be afraid of, you know, not being able to care for their families.
Lauren, we've got it. You've laid out a lot there. Jack Beatty, join us here. Lauren is thinking outside the box, even if the presidential candidates are not entirely. She's saying, let's get health care in here. Let's get some green environmental work going, and let's not stack all the work that there is up on the shoulders of folks who are already working.
Yeah, you know, I mean, she has good ideas. I mean, it would be good for the environment to do the green energy. It would certainly be good for distribution of health care to have national health insurance. The trouble is that all of this happens under the sign of grave structural deficits, a $44 trillion funding gap between projected obligations of the federal government for the next 75 years and projected revenues, if everything stays the same. Now, we can't function that way, and we can't leave that to our children. And I'm really afraid that many of these ambitious spending programs on the part of Kerry and Bush's further tax cuts simply are unaffordable in the facing the reality of what this funding gap is going to mean, unless we have basically decided that all of our bills are going to be paid in by our children and grandchildren paying, you know, I've seen estimates of 15-20% higher taxes to pay for our consumption.
Tom Kochan, we've just got a couple of minutes left. What about it? Is the deficit pit so deep that we need to... I don't know, a low cost, a bootstraps way out of this? Does the debt have to be pushed forward to next generations?
Well, I think the deficit is a terrible problem, a terrible burden to leave to our children that none of us want to face. So we have to do some of the things that Lauren is suggesting. We have to find incremental solutions to our health care problem by moving it out of the backs of individual businesses and slowly moving it so that it is a shared responsibility. But I think there's another point, and that's why I'm delighted to hear from people like Lauren and Scott. The workforce itself has to have much more of a control over their own destiny. So if we start to get back to the American principle of giving people the tools they need to get ahead in society, good education, refunding education, providing jobs of the future through community colleges and universities.
But Jack says we don't have the money to do
it. Well, but I think the reality is that a lot of these things don't cost as much money as we believe if we get local industries working with community colleges so that the jobs that are being – or the education that's being created fits the jobs of the region. So local solutions, building more collaborative relationships between business and labor – rebuilding worker voice on the job so that they can start to assert their interests.
30 seconds left. President Bush's spokesman at the top of our hour said George Bush has the pro-growth stance here. That's what we need.
Well, but it's the same pro-growth stance that he's had for the last 3.5 years, and look where it got us.
Negative or, well, very, very little job growth, perhaps.
Right.
The lowest level since 1932. That's a long time.
That's a long time, and we certainly can't continue.
Well, George Bush says stick with it. John Kerry's got a different message. Going to hear a lot more on the economy in the weeks ahead. Tom Kochan, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Tom Kochan, an economist at the Institute for Work and Employment Research at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, remembering actress Faye Ray. This is On Point. Hollywood icon Faye Ray, who earned everlasting fame as the screaming damsel carried up the Empire State Building by King Kong in the 1933 movie classic, died yesterday in her Manhattan apartment. She was 96 years old. Ray appeared in more than 80 films in her career, including the original version of The Four Feathers and the silent classic The Wedding March. For all that, Ray will always be remembered for playing an unemployed actress who becomes the object of a giant ape's lofty affections. Rick McKay is a longtime friend of Fay Wray and directed the last film she appeared in. In this on-point tribute, he recalls what it was about Fay Wray's performance in King Kong that has kept her a household name 70 years after the film's release.
Well, I think it was a combination of natural beauty and strength. I mean, what woman was in the paw of, you know, a giant ape and survived it? The combination of beauty and strength and vulnerability, because you didn't often see and still haven't. Very few people have been able to perfect it. Actresses making a completely vulnerable female form who actually is strong enough to not only win the battle with an ape, but make him fall in love with her. And it's a basic part of human nature that I think there was a whole generation of young guys, too, who were 13, 14 years old, who saw that movie 70 years ago, and it affected them. I mean, she's on the first page of the novel Myra Breckinridge by Gore Vidal, even. And John Updike has written about the effect that she had on his life. She seemed to have crossed all barriers.
Feeling better?
Yes, thank you. You're very kind.
Don't you fool yourself. I'm not bothering about you just out of kindness. How'd you ever get into this fix?
Bad luck, I guess. But then there are a lot of girls like me.
She made sometimes up to 10 movies in 1 year, which is hard to imagine today. She often said that Kong made one movie, and she made 80, but everyone still remembered the one that he made, you know, King Kong. And making a movie that becomes that iconic, I think, almost haunted her in a way. People forgot that she made The Wedding March, which was one of the great films ever made by Erich von Stroheim. She also decided a few years later that because she was being stereotyped as this quote-unquote scream queen, that she would go to London to work because she was being offered films there to work with Claude Rains and Jack Buchanan. So she went across the ocean on a ship, and when she arrived, the BBC came to interview her, and they were like, "Miss Wray, we are so excited that you've come to work in London." And she said, "Thank you, it's such an honor to work with British actors." And they said, "Can we ask you, would you mind coming to the BBC studio and screaming over the air for all of England?" And you have to remember, in those days, going from Hollywood to New York and then to London was across the world, you know, before we had Concorde and things like that. So to go that far to escape the stereotype and still have the BBC reporter ask you to come to the studio and scream that night, she said, that's when I realized it was bigger than I was. We talked about the scream. She was lucky because what she asked for when she did King Kong is that she was able to go into a recording studio herself and do all of the screams and then let them edit them into the film as they wanted. But she told me she always thought of it as an aria of screams that she did. She went in there and treated it as an operatic aria and screamed through the gamut of emotions from A to Z. And, of course, there's always been rumors that some of the great films over the next 30 years or so would steal those Fay Wray screams from that recording. It did become frustrating to her that people would take, you know, one of the great actresses who'd worked with von Stroheim and call her the original Scream Queen. She didn't like that title.
Rick McKay, a longtime friend of Fay Wray. He directed the last film in which she appeared, Broadway, The Golden Age. Fay Wray died yesterday. She was 96. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.